It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Rarely does the dynamic of a debate change as quickly as it has over same-sex marriage. Just about a decade ago, no U.S. state recognized such marriages. Many outright banned recognition in their constitutions, and only one, Vermont, offered any legal status at all to gay and lesbian couples in the form of civil unions. Polls showed Americans were largely opposed to recognizing same-sex unions, and federal law explicitly defined marriage as between a man and a woman. But that was 10 years ago. Today, more than a dozen states and the District of Columbia have enacted marriage equality laws, including New Hampshire, and several more recognize civil unions or domestic partnerships. Polls in 2013 show majority support for legalizing gay marriage. And yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA. In the first of two major rulings yesterday on marriage, Justice Anthony Kennedy said, quote, DOMA writes inequality into the entire United States Code, from Social Security benefits to tax laws. The High Court's second ruling was more narrowly focused, deciding essentially not to decide a case against a same-sex marriage ban in California, but supporters of marriage equality hailed it as a victory nonetheless, as the court's decision clears the way for gay and lesbian couples to marry in that state. But these rulings haven't settled the debate over marriage. There are big legal and political considerations ahead, and activists on all sides say they'll continue speaking out about the issue. Today in The Exchange, the Supreme Court has its say on same-sex marriage, and let's hear from you. What was your reaction to yesterday's decisions? How has the debate over marriage or the Defense of Marriage Act affected you? What questions do you have about the ruling? Call in at the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or send a question or comment through our Facebook page. We have a panel of New Hampshire legal experts here in the studio to walk us through these rulings. But first, joining us is Jim Splaine, a former Democratic state representative and senator from Portsmouth, and the author of New Hampshire's marriage equality law, which passed in 2009, took effect the following year. Jim Splaine, welcome back to The Exchange.
Nice to talk with you, Grady.
A lot of gay rights supporters have described these rulings as big victories for their cause. Do you see them that way?
Oh, yes. I think it's a big victory for America and the concept of equality and freedom. You know, and the concept of with liberty and justice for all means something. It's more than just words that we say as part of our Pledge of Allegiance. And this ruling makes it clear that we want to treat, in the United States of America, we want to treat people equally. That's an important step.
And when you say treat people equally, what is the practical effect then that you might see in a state like New Hampshire that already has a state law enacting same-sex marriage?
Well, the practical effect is going to be that we are now fulfilling the promise that we made in 2009 when we passed gay marriage on the state level by making sure that those marriages are full marriages. They're recognized by the federal government. In 2009, when New Hampshire became just the fifth state in the country to adopt gay marriage, we were allowing all people who are gay and lesbian to be able to be married under state laws, but of course the federal laws did not apply. And as of today, those federal laws, including all of the benefits, but more importantly, the recognition by the federal government, applies to all of our residents who in New Hampshire who are married. And as of yesterday, checked this with the New Hampshire Bureau of Vital Statistics, there have been 2,335 marriages in New Hampshire since House Bill 436 became law on January 1st of 2010. That's a remarkable gift to the residents of New Hampshire, to everyone, not just our gay and lesbian residents, but to everyone, that those marriages are now equal.
But now we should say that while New Hampshire has a same-sex marriage law and the DOMA decision would affect them, people who live in states which don't have same-sex marriage law or explicitly ban it may have a very different effect. Would you have liked to have seen the court rule more broadly on whether or not there is a right for people who are in gay and lesbian relationships to marry?
Oh, absolutely. And I would have liked to have seen that, and I think they eventually will. The cause continues. There's 37 states. Now with California, there's 13 states with marriage equality, including D.C. There are 37 states where it is not legal. 31 of those states have constitutional amendments specifically saying that marriage is just between a man and a woman. Those constitutional requirements even make it difficult for any kind of civil unions or domestic partnerships to be given to residents in those states. So the cause continues. But with California, some 30% of Americans now will be living in states where there is marriage equality. I think we're going to have to see the adventure continue, the cause continue to make sure that we have marriage equality in all parts of this country. But so much, and you said this at the beginning of the program, so much has changed just in the past decade. And I think that's remarkable. When people finally get a feel for equality, they don't stop the march toward more.
Well, Jim Splain, thanks so much, as always, for taking the time and talking with us today.
Nice talking with you. Have a good day.
Thanks. That's Jim Splain, former Democratic state representative and senator from Portsmouth. He wrote New Hampshire's marriage law, which passed in 2009. Today on The Exchange, we're talking about the Supreme Court's rulings on same-sex marriage, and we invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. As I mentioned, we have two legal scholars in the studio with us today. Jordan Budd is a professor at UNH School of Law, specializing in civil rights, constitutional law, and the federal courts. Jordan Budd, great to have you with us.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
And Buzz Schur is here. He's a professor at UNH Law, chair and president of the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. And Buzz Schur, welcome back to The Exchange.
Pleasure to be here again.
There's a lot to parse out in these rulings, because it's not simply to say that the court ruled on same-sex marriage, because in a lot of ways they only ruled on very particular aspects of same-sex marriage. Let's start with the ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act, Jordan Budd, DOMA. What exactly is the court saying here about same-sex marriage, and what exactly is it not saying?
The distinction is very important. The court, in the majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy, walks a fairly fine line between a general condemnation of discrimination against same-sex couples. And there's a lot of language in the opinion that would support the idea that it is generally impermissible for government to engage in that kind of discrimination. He writes that the DOMA, it demeans and disparages and degrades and humiliates, inflicts indignity and inequality and injury. Those are broad, obviously, concepts, and you know, the condemning reach of them, you would think, is, you know, pretty much unlimited. But in the same opinion, sometimes in the same passage, he then walks back and says, but this is only applicable to discrimination against marriages that have been recognized in those 13 states that have taken that step, or the 12 states. In the
so in other words,
Columbia.
If the state opens the door, Buzz, to couples that are gay and lesbian couples marrying, then the federal government can't then subsequently shut the door when it comes to federal benefits and
exactly.
Federal treatment.
The particular case, the circumstance involved in the DOMA case was a woman named Edie Windsor, who's an 80-plus-year-old woman. She and her partner were married for many years, and her partner died. And because it was a same-sex marriage at the time not recognized by DOMA, she had to pay $350,000+ worth of estate tax that if she were married, if it were a heterosexual marriage, she would not have had to pay. So it was a very crystal clear case of discrimination based on who you married.
I think it's surprising to a lot of people to see, and the justices wrote about this in the majority, that there are hundreds and hundreds of ways in which marriage is written into the estate tax code is one example, but there are so many others in so many aspects of the federal law.
Yeah, the number that's out there now is somewhere around 1,000 different ways that you're cut off from some sort of federal benefit or punished in some way by the nature of who you've married.
And Jordan, I noticed that Justice Kennedy, in writing that majority opinion, spoke about the Fifth Amendment as the basis for a lot of the decision. And the part that I noticed in that amendment, it says, quote, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of the law. And he said that without that due process, the liberty of these couples were being infringed. Given that Congress passed a law, how does the due process factor in there? Or do we know that yet?
Well, he's referring there to a concept that's been derived from that language, but which isn't clearly traceable to the words themselves. And it's called substantive due process. And substantive due process is a concept that's been developed by the court over the last century, more than a century. And it's had various incarnations over the years. But in its present form, it's understood as a limitation on government's ability to step over some indistinct line. But the court knows it when it sees it. In treating the citizenry with disrespect, treating them in a way that doesn't affirm their basic, as the court says, personhood. So the operative legal principle, although he never uses the phrase substantive due process, it's an interesting opinion because while the result is powerful, intentionally the analysis is left quite indistinct. So you have to read the opinion very carefully to figure out what exactly is driving the analysis. It's very clear what the conclusion is, but the analysis is rooted in lots of different relatively vague references to legal principles, the due process, substantive due process being one. And so what he's saying in those passages is that when government steps over this line and treats people in a way that fundamentally denies their personhood, it is impermissible. And when Congress does that, it's subject to the Fifth Amendment. And when the states do it, it's subject to the 14th Amendment. Any governmental entity can't step over that line. And the court in the Windsor case is saying very clearly that that line is crossed over when Congress, or in this case involving Congress, deprives certain married couples in states that recognize marriage the same benefits that other couples in the same state enjoy. That's the limitation. And that limitation doesn't really derive clearly from substantive due process, although you could argue it's connected, but it deprives more broadly from federalism principles.
And we'll pick right back up after that, after a short break. We invite you to join us with your comments and questions as we parse out what's in the rulings that the Supreme Court made this week on same-sex marriage. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And what's going on this week at NHPR? Well, there's an easy way for you to find out when you sign up for our new e-newsletter this week at NHPR. You'll find out what the exchange, word of mouth, and our newsroom are planning for the week and get a behind-the-scenes look at the station. Click on the Connect menu to sign up for our e-newsletter at nhpr.org. More on the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage on the exchange and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. More on the far-reaching effects of this week's Supreme Court rulings. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And Huggins Hospital in Wolfboro, providing a continuum of health care to both year-round and summer residents of the Eastern Lakes region, on the web at hugginshospital.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, the Supreme Court's rulings on DOMA and California's Proposition 8. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment or a question on our Facebook page. Joining me in the studio for the hour, Jordan Budd and Buzscher of the UNH School of Law. And just before the break, we were talking about some of the indistinct or perhaps vague parts of this ruling. And Buzscher, I wanted to ask you, does this ruling on the Defense of Marriage Act state who, what government entities or what other entities has the right to define marriage, or does it not?
There's a strong suggestion that DOMA was misplaced in that it took over from the states some of the role in defining what a marriage constitutes and what benefits comes with it and what doesn't. And there's a strong suggestion that marriage historically has been a matter for the states to regulate one way or another. And so that's certainly a theme in Kennedy's opinion. Remains to be played out in future litigation whether the when someone challenges a state's constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, whether the U.S. Supreme Court will say the federal constitution says you can't do this for all the reasons Jordan described as Kennedy saying it's unfair to make this distinction.
So one of the interesting ways of parsing the majority opinion is to look at two of the dissents, Chief Justice Roberts' dissents and then Justice Scalia's dissents. And they take two very different views of the majority opinion. Chief Justice Roberts goes to great lengths to say this is a federalism decision. This is simply a statement that Congress can't usurp states and interfere with states' ability to define marriage, but it's a state-by-state analysis, no more, no less.
And the court then in his piece is saying we're not weighing in on marriage here. We're weighing in on a separation of powers issue.
Exactly. Now Justice Kennedy says explicitly that his opinion isn't rooted exclusively in federalism, but it's got a toe in that pond. And Chief Justice Roberts seizes on it because that's the analysis of the majority that obviously limits its reach most dramatically. Justice Scalia, on the other hand, says that's just that's all empty rhetoric. Clearly what the majority is trying to do is lay the groundwork for, in the very near future, taking the next step and saying, as a matter of substantive due process, a concept that Justice Scalia disdains, no governmental entity, federal or state, can discriminate against same-sex couples in marriage.
And now on a pro – go ahead, Buzz.
And just to add one little piece, there's also a theme less apparent than the unarticulated substantive due process argument and the articulated federalism argument. There's also an equal protection theme in Kennedy's opinion, too, that you got to treat people in the same situation, that is, married people, the same, unless there's a very, very, very good reason for a distinction.
And there is a practical set of questions now that's coming up as well, being that since the federal Defense of Marriage Act has been overturned, there's an open question now if a person, say, who lived in a state that banned same-sex marriage in its constitution could come to New Hampshire, get married, go back to their state, and what is the status of that relationship in that home state? If the state may not recognize it, but the federal government does, so you start to think about tax forms and many other questions that come up.
So that's exactly where the issue is going to shift to now, and there will be two places where that issue will play out. It'll play out in the courts, but it'll also likely play out in the form of federal regulations that the Obama administration will promulgate that'll say how do we implement this sort of this new legal regime. And likely people who have been married in a state when they were residents or domiciled in that state and moved to another state after they secured a marriage from their home state will be able to enjoy the benefits of DOMA. But their marriage under the other provision of DOMA that was not struck down will not be recognized for state benefits in their new state. But there's a real interesting question whether this will permit couples who live in a state that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage to fly to New Hampshire for a weekend, be married, and fly home, whether they then will be able to enjoy the benefits of DOMA or the striking down of DOMA, enjoy the benefits of the federal scheme while obviously not enjoying the state scheme. And that's going to be a much tougher call, but it's going to be played out in the courts and also played out in the form of federal regulations.
Still many more questions to answer. And joining us now is someone who may be able to shed a little bit of light on some of these questions. It's Chris Paul. He practices trusts and estate law for the McLean Law Firm. Chris Paul, welcome to The Exchange.
Good morning, Brady. Thanks for having me on.
The court's ruling on DOMA says there are more than 1,000 areas where marriage plays into federal law, and some of those cross into what you do. Do you now have to go through trust and estate law line by line to figure out exactly what this means?
Well, Professor Budd earlier was talking about some of the uncertainty, and we're going to be waiting for sort of additional guidance from federal regulations in the courts. But practically speaking, for a New Hampshire, say, for example, a New Hampshire same-sex married couple, estate planning is certainly going to get a lot easier. Prior to yesterday's decision, same-sex couples, whether legally married or in civil unions or registered domestic partnerships, couldn't avail themselves of a lot of the federal benefits and privileges that heterosexual married couples had, and hence their estate plans tended to be a lot more complex. And certainly has been well written that many of the standard benefits that married people enjoy and expect, like Social Security survivors benefits, veterans benefits, income tax, preferential treatment, et cetera, while not technically in an estate planning regime, often inform same-sex couples or heterosexual couples on what their estate plan should be. So from a practical standpoint, in New Hampshire, same-sex married couples, estate planning now becomes quite a bit easier. And as Buzz pointed out earlier, the Supreme Court case, the Windsor case here, was prompted by an estate tax issue.
An estate tax case, exactly. But you said you're probably going to have to wait for a lot of guidance from federal regulators, and that takes time. And also, given that it touches so many different aspects of the federal government, that's also going to play out in different agencies, possibly in different ways.
Certainly. And when I say we're going to have to wait, as Professor Budd was speaking earlier, what happens to legally married same-sex couples in states that don't recognize same-sex marriages? There may still be a lot of estate tax, estate planning uncertainty, and certainly state planning deals not only with federal law, but state law. So there's this patchwork of mosaic, I guess, of complexity that still needs to be dealt with. Also, when it comes to the Internal Revenue Service, I think the jury's still out on a lot of the practical issues. For instance, same-sex couples who have been filing separately because of DOMA now may have the ability to go back and amend prior returns to avail themselves of maybe better tax treatment. But right now, there's a 3-year statute of limitations on filing amended returns. So it's anybody's guess on whether or not the IRS will write regulations that allow people to file amended returns in specific circumstances.
So if a client came to you and said, we're a gay or lesbian couple and we're looking at setting up our estate planning right now, would you just say watch and wait for the time being? And
oh, no.
Hold tight? No, you'd start
not.
The process anyway.
Yeah, and we've actually been advising clients for quite a while now in anticipation of ultimately DOMA being challenged and overturned, is to file in an estate tax case, maybe file what I call a protective or a prophylactic return, much like Edie Windsor did, and make the claim that the unlimited marital deduction applied and I'm not paying the tax, and then ultimately pay the tax when it gets assessed. But it allows you to challenge it later. And we've built in sort of flexibility into same-sex couples' estate plans to sort of be able to react or adjust to the various changes in regulations and rules and the law. So, but again, as a practical matter in New Hampshire right now, much of the complexity that was caused by DOMA is gone. And so same-sex New Hampshire couples certainly can proceed with estate planning much like they did, much like heterosexual couples did.
Well, Chris Paul, thanks so much for taking the time and talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Chris Paul practices trusts and estates law for the McLean Law Firm. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the Supreme Court rulings on same-sex marriage, and we hope you'll call in with your questions and comments at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. With me in the studio, Buzz Scher and Jordan Budd of the UNH School of Law. And one thing that Chris mentioned a moment ago was the idea of people filing things so that they could potentially be challenged later. And that reminds me of something that came up in the Proposition 8 case, the issue of standing. And it's sort of a very complicated process, but if you could give us the 30-second version, Jordan, of exactly why the court ruled the way that it did on Proposition 8.
Sure. 30 seconds is tough when it comes to standing. It's one of the most obscure concepts in American law. But the Article 3, which gives federal courts their power, says that federal courts can hear cases or controversies. It has to be a case or a controversy. And the court has interpreted that phrase to mean that the litigants in federal court have to have a live interest in the dispute. It has to affect them, in the court's words, in a particularized and personal way.
Like Edie Windsor and her tax.
You bet. She had a very personal and particularized interest in this lawsuit. She was out $363,000. In the California case, very different alignment of parties. What you had in the challenge to Prop 8 was a case brought by people who were truly injured by the proposition, injured in the sense of standing, because they were denied the right to marry. They went to the Alameda and the Los Angeles County clerks, asked for a marriage license, and were denied the license because of Proposition 8. They filed suit, win in the district court. Then an appeal is taken to the Ninth Circuit. But at that point, the state of California, the political dynamic in the state government had changed. And Governor Schwarzenegger and the Attorney General at the time, who's now the governor, Jerry Brown, both agreed that they would no longer defend the statute.
And the Supreme Court was saying, if the state of California decides not to defend it, you can't have another group step in and say, we're representing the
state,
because they don't have standing to do that.
That was the question, is whether the proponents of the initiative could then step in for the state. And the court in Hollingsworth versus Perry said, no, that's not a particularized and personal interest. It's what they call a generalized grievance, and federal courts are prohibited by the Constitution from hearing those kinds of claims.
And we're going to come back to that in a moment. But joining us now is Ashley Pratt. She's executive director of Cornerstone, a conservative think tank located in Concord. Ashley Pratt, welcome back to The Exchange.
Hi, thank you, Brady. Thanks for having me.
As we mentioned earlier in the show, gay rights supporters have been hailing the court's decisions as victories. Do you then conversely see them as setbacks?
Well, it's interesting. I was actually out on a Focus on the Family conference, so all of these state directors of Family Policy Councils were together for the ruling, so it kind of helped us to dissect what it meant for the future of our movement. We see it as kind of, it's easier to look at it from what the court did not do. And for us, it certainly did not create a constitutional right to same-sex marriage as it did for abortion in 1973. And it also did not declare same-sex marriage a civil right. So essentially, it made it a state's rights issue under DOMA, which said that, you know, obviously in New Hampshire, same-sex marriages, which are already being recognized, will continue to be recognized. But in states like Arizona, where it's not, they obviously maintain that right to define marriage how they choose with the amendments that they have in place.
So you would be in favor of letting this process continue to play out, as I think one of the dissents said, let the democratic process play out, voters and states can decide rather than courts?
Yeah, that was actually Scalia's quote, I believe. He had said something to the effect of that they have no power to decide in this case, and if they did, they even have no power under the Constitution to invalidate this democratically adopted legislation. So they found it wasn't the court's place to decide, you know, to overturn something like Prop 8, even though the standing piece of it came into play. They had realized, you know, obviously in these cases, for the 7 million, you know, voters in California, their vote was not invalidated by, you know, the Supreme Court.
As you know, as well as I do, that we've seen a lot of change in recent years on marriage, in public opinion, in politics, and now in jurisprudence. Even in some of the polls, you start to see people who say, I'm opposed to gay marriage, but I now see it as inevitable. What comes next for you?
Yeah, that's obviously something that we battle with daily, but we do have, you know, our faithful supporters who are out there who believe that marriage is obviously between one man and one woman. And it's a critical role of a man and woman marriage that we believe is not diminished by the rulings that occurred, because there is an essential need for children to have both a married mother and a father. And that is in no way lessened by the opinions that occurred. So we're out there. We're still trying to support and defend marriage in the best way that we can, in the definition of one man, one woman. And that's something that obviously the Supreme Court cannot take away.
Ashley Pratt, thanks so much for taking the time and talking with us.
Thank you so much, Brady. Take care.
That's Ashley Pratt, executive director of Cornerstone, a conservative think tank located in Concord.
We're in the studio with Buzz Scher and Jordan Budd of the UNH School of Law, taking a look at this week's Supreme Court rulings on same-sex marriage, including striking down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act and ruling on California's Proposition 8. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And let's hear now from one of our listeners. Philip is calling from New Hampton. Hi, Philip. You're on The Exchange.
Oh, thank you. I have a question about states that recognize civil unions and companies that recognize domestic partnerships and offer benefits to those couples. Is it just semantics, or will federal benefits be offered to those couples as well, or will they have to actually be a gay marriage?
It's a very good question, Philip, and I'll ask you, Buzz. Sure, that's one more wrinkle in an already very complex situation.
Yeah, and it's a wrinkle that is not addressed at all effectively in the E.D. Windsor case, in the DOMA case, and it's a wrinkle that will have to be sorted out, whether the court for purposes of DOMA and whether the federal government for purposes of DOMA recognizes civil unions as the equivalent of marriage.
Jordan?
The civil unions have historically been treated as not qualifying as a marriage for purposes of federal benefits. So while DOMA has been taken off the table, the concept of marriage, which is, in the wake of the decision striking down DOMA, really a matter of for states to decide, is still going to be the operative concept. And so I would be surprised if, in the wake of the Windsor decision, the federal benefits were extended to couples in states that recognize civil unions but don't recognize marriage, if in those states federal benefits would be extended. I think that would be inconsistent with the majority's analysis.
The more likely focus is going to be in those states with civil unions, either through litigation or through the legislature, to change civil unions into a same-sex marriage statutes rather than fiddle around with a fight about what do we call civil unions now.
Thank you so much, Philip, for that call. We invite you to join us at The Exchange, number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take more of your questions and comments, and we'll talk more about the Supreme Court's rulings this week on same-sex marriage. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Santa's Village in Jefferson, celebrating its 60th anniversary of creating family fun and memories to last a lifetime. Information and tickets online at santasvillage.com. And Stonewall Farm, a nonprofit working farm and education center, Chesterfield Road, Keene, hosting their annual Farm-Made Ice Cream Social this Saturday. Stonewallfarm.org. Good morning. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
What people say in the public square is important for citizens to know about.
Which is why you turned to NHPR and Josh Rogers, senior political reporter.
I do my best to pay attention to what public officials say and do, to hold public officials to some account.
New Hampshire's newsroom, covering New Hampshire's political news. NHPR and NHPR.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Email us your questions before the show at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for The Exchange. Today, we're looking at the Supreme Court's rulings on same-sex marriage. After months of anticipation, the High Court overturned the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and California's Proposition 8 met an end, paving the way for same-sex marriage to return to California. Both are considered major decisions for the gay rights movement. movement. We're looking closely at these rulings and whether they mean much for the Granite State. Our guests, Jordan Budd and Buzz Scher of UNH School of Law, and we'd like to hear from you as well at 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. And we got an email a little while ago from Jordan in Auburn, who said, years ago, I was proud of New Hampshire's passage and of same-sex marriage, and yesterday was a great step forward. Judge Walker, referring to a judge in California, and Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court, gave great precedent for future cases for our rights, but we will not stop until we can travel to every U.S. state and territory and be acknowledged as married. And Jordan's email brings up something that has come up throughout this conversation since the rulings were issued. There is a lot more to come. We don't know necessarily in what fashion, but this is a beginning, not necessarily an end.
Absolutely. The question is left unanswered by the Windsor opinion, and obviously by Hollingsworth as well, which is just a procedural disposition, is whether there is a fundamental constitutional right to marry, even in states that would otherwise choose to deny same-sex couples that opportunity. And that question was not addressed in Windsor. It could have been. That's the way Windsor was written is the hallmark of a Justice Kennedy opinion. He's on the razor's edge of the court. There's four on one side, four on the other. And the court goes only so far as Justice Kennedy is ready to go. And yesterday he was ready to say in states that recognize same-sex marriage, all benefits apply, state and federal. He went no further but left open explicitly the question for another day. And there are challenges in the pipeline. There are two cases coming out of Nevada, and I believe they're is either one from Arizona or Hawaii, two more in the Ninth Circuit that are heading straight to the Supreme Court seeking review in the next term that squarely present the question whether states that prohibit same-sex marriage are constitutionally barred from doing so. And that was the question that was teed up in the California case, but which wasn't reached because of the standing.
And Buzz, at the same time as Justice Kennedy was perhaps walking this fine line, Justice Scalia, his colleague, wrote in the dissent, and I'll just quote, by formally declaring anyone opposed to same-sex marriage an enemy of human decency, the majority arms well every challenger to a state law restricting marriage to its traditional definition. So question is, does the ruling, have the seeds of a broader case down the road?
It certainly does. And what's interesting about Justice Scalia's language in that, it's very similar to his language in a case called Lawrence versus Texas several years ago, which in which Kennedy, in dissent, that Lawrence versus Texas found unconstitutional a sodomy statute, sexual activity between consenting people of the same sex, and in Lawrence versus Texas, in response to a Kennedy opinion, Scalia said, "Oh no, this is just opening the door to a recognition of things like same-sex marriage," and sure enough, so it's a funny and odd reprise of Scalia language from a prior opinion, and it does. In that sense, he's right. It certainly Kennedy's language is in many ways very expansive, and tees up the question that Jordan talked about that's already in the works is, can a state ban same-sex marriages? And that will raise, given that the federal constitution may guarantee a right to same-sex marriage.
Right, and that question, it's coming to the court, and it'll land on the court's doorstep this, actually, I think next week. The cert petitions from Nevada may be arriving, and there may be, or have already arrived, and there may be a disposition within the next few weeks, but if the court doesn't decide to address the question next term, and it would not be surprising if the court chose to wait a while to address that final decision. Institutionally, clearly there is a benefit to the court in being perceived as engaged in incremental change. But at some point, it may be 2 years, it may be 5 years, the court will take that case and will address the question whether this substantive due process principle embedded in the Fifth Amendment that we've been talking about creates a fundamental right to marry. And that question will be decided based, if the court's composition doesn't change, by Justice Kennedy again. and his view on the reach of the substantive due process clause.
One of the most, in the broadest sense, one of the interesting things about where we are now is a change from, you go back to some a court like the Warren Court, where there was a perception, correctly or not, that the Warren Court was apace with leading social change. In the 60s.
Was some years ahead of the country with Brown versus Board of Education, ending segregation,
on a number of discrimination issues. And you listen to this discussion, and I think there's this palpable feel that the Roberts Court is a following social change court at best. It's really not the Roberts Court. It's the four liberals and Kennedy. Even they are taking a kind of follow social change position rather than a leading social change position. So it's an interesting movement over the last several decades.
Is that typical of the court as we see it in 2013 now then, to issue more narrowly construed decisions on most cases? I mean, we see a lot of 5-4 cases, right, not always with the same majority and minority, but trying to, rather than issue a broad sweeping decision, trying to parse out particular elements and not go further than that.
Well, this is Justice Kennedy's court, and it really depends on how Justice Kennedy views the particular issue. There were, I think, last term some very significant number of 5-4 decisions, and I believe last term every single decision, Justice Kennedy was in the majority. He was the fifth vote. About 3/4 of the time he goes with the conservative bloc, about 1/4 of the time he goes with the so-called liberal bloc. But he is not repudiated the view of, in many other contexts, the view of those conservative justices who I think would take it a step further than even Buzz's accurate characterization suggests, which is they don't follow social change. They believe that the Constitution is really exists irrespective of social change, that it is a document that must be understood as it was originally conceived and enacted, and is an unchanging document until the formal amendment process kicks in. And in that view, it's all about tradition and what was done at the time the Constitution or the relevant provision of the Constitution was enacted. And under that view, which is Justice Scalia's view, there's no conceivable scenario where there's a constitutional entitlement to same-sex marriage. The four justices on the liberal end of the spectrum have a completely different view of the Constitution. It's aspirational. Constitution is a living document that moves forward and is responsive to, if not leading, at least responsive to social change. And in some other contexts, Justice Kennedy has adopted that approach. So depending on how he views that fundamental question of constitutional interpretation, the next step will be a broad right to gay marriage, or the next step will be nothing further than we see right now.
Well, let me ask you one more question about Proposition 8, which, as we mentioned, was not so much a ruling about marriage, but was about that question of standing, that an outside group couldn't represent the state of California in the case. The court ruled for the first time, really, that if the executive in California and the legislative branch didn't want to defend the law, that you couldn't have this group come in instead. Does that then open up the door for a governor or a president even to use the court system to undo laws that he or she doesn't like? That you could sort of see, oh, well, someone's suing this law. I don't like it. I'll just choose not to defend it and see what happens.
The short answer is it's a complicated answer, and it depends. I think In a sense, the court's ruling on this standing issue, as Jordan characterized it, was somewhat expected, number one, and is consistent with this court's what has tended to be a very conservative view of standing. That this court, in a lot of other contexts, where civil liberties organizations and civil rights advocacy organizations have tried to create standing in circumstances that were on the margins of the traditional or kind of an old version of standing, this court has clamped down on that. So in that sense, this has been, their ruling in this was a classically conservative Supreme Court statement of the standing proposition that just happened to benefit the governor and attorney general of California circumstance in favor of civil liberties.
And I think that that's most powerfully illustrated by the fact that in the California case, dismissing the case on standing grounds, Justice Scalia is in the majority, which had the obvious effect of benefiting same-sex couples in California, because the principle decided there was, as he understood it, the scope of the federal judicial power. And his answer to the question you raise, which is true, that there could well be circumstances where the executive branch can thwart an enactment of the people by simply choosing not to enforce it and then saying, well, we're the only ones who can go to court and defend it. We choose not to, so that's the end of it. I think Justice Scalia's answer would be that the proper remedy there is not to expand federal power to hear cases that the Constitution, through that case or controversy language, contemplates the federal court should decide. The answer is not to go to the federal court and expand its power, but for the people to throw the bums out.
Since we're talking about where the court is standing on some of these issues, I wanted to ask you just briefly, Buzz, about the other big case that the court brought a decision on this week, which is on the Federal Voting Rights Act, striking down the key provision which required certain states to get preclearance to make changes to their election laws. What can we learn between that ruling and what we've seen on same-sex marriage? I don't know if there are parallels.
Well, there's a couple interesting lessons. To be completely accurate about it, the court didn't strike down the provision of the Voting Rights Act, Section 5, that requires preclearance for certain states that qualify under Section 4 as requiring preclearance. It struck down Section 4, which essentially was the formula for those to determine which states qualify.
By which, okay.
So technically, there is still a preclearance requirement, but the court said, we don't like the fact that Congress hasn't changed that for a long time. It's using standards that are archaic, for lack of a better, and need to be updated. Congress is free to update them. So the preclearance requirement is still there, but nobody qualifies anymore until they update that. So one of the interesting things about the opinion is yet another example, as Jordan was talking about, Kennedy is on the conservative side, and it's another 5-4 opinion, and Kennedy's vote is the one that brought that to that result, which is a from a civil liberties perspective, is not a good civil liberties decision. It makes it harder for the federal government to, in an aggressive and effective way, oversee changes in voter laws in states that might have an undue effect on minorities. That is one view of the effect of the court's decision. But just a classic example of, as Jordan has put it, this is Kennedy's court.
And so where he goes, the court goes.
On these issues, very much so.
As we start to wrap up the hour, I wanted to ask a little bit about the practical effects for courts and for the federal government as they process these rulings. We heard a little bit from Chris Paul about he was going to wait for advice from federal regulators about some of these policies and procedures. Jordan, what's going to go on now? The court has ruled. Does the federal government then just have to take some time, think it through, and then issue its advisories?
Well, the federal court or the federal government doesn't have to do that. It would probably be advisable for the Obama administration to start thinking about that, though, to get ahead of some of these really complex questions that are otherwise going to come up through the courts. And as they come through the cases presented by the same-sex couple married in New Hampshire that moves to Arizona, and how do you sort through their rights and benefits and the like? If those cases come up through the courts, there's lots of courts. There's 94 district courts. There's many federal circuit courts. You could very quickly come to a situation where you have inconsistent rulings among the various lower federal courts, and it takes time for all of that to work its way to the Supreme Court to be resolved in application. So I suspect that the Obama administration will likely, in relatively short order, begin promulgating regulations that tell the states what it understands.
Here's what we think the
decision to mean with respect to federal benefits.
And practically speaking, the other thing that's going to go on is a lot of advocacy organizations are going to be going into the states and making legislative efforts to change things. For example, the ACLU, who represented E.D. Windsor in the DOMA case, announced yesterday that they have hired Steve Schmidt, a former John McCain campaign manager in the 2008 election.
And a supporter of gay marriage.
To reach out to Republicans around the country to try and be more inclusive in bringing Republicans and others together to get legislative change around the country. So it's going to be, you know, this is a midpoint. It's not an endpoint, mm-hmm. both in terms of legislative activity and litigation and federal government activity.
A midpoint, not an endpoint. Well, we're at the endpoint of this hour, but seeing as how we expect a lot more to come, I hope that you'll leave a little bit more space in each of your calendars so that when the next set of rulings or the next set of votes comes through that we can talk with you again. Thanks so much to both of you for coming in.
Pleasure.
That's Jordan Budd, professor at UNH School of Law, who specializes in civil rights, constitutional law, and the federal courts, and Bud Scherer, professor at UNH School of Law, chair and president of the New Hampshire Civil Liberties Union. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Catherine Muzzy. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Key Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy.